You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and I am almost positive that today is July 13th, 2022. As I keep saying, and I know I keep saying this, and I'm sorry about this, but I have so many books in preparation. And of course, Anomalism 1 is finished. I will let you know immediately when that is finally published. These things do take a while. I wasn't able, some of you may have wondered where I was at Freedom Palooza this year. I wasn't able to go. And I'm sorry for Paul Tapiti for that, of course, lead singer of Poker Face, the original right-wing hard rock band. Excellent group of guys. I endorse what they do. I want to remind everyone, too, about my merchandising, and this is going to always be updated. We have so many different designs. People have been using an email address to introduce new ones. It's selling pretty well. And these are going to be a lot of right-wing and royalist Russian and Orthodox themes that you normally can't get T-shirts made out of. And you certainly aren't going to find this even on eBay, let alone in Walmart. And remember, to support me financially in every other way, the website, I mean, the rushjournal.org is still, I need to update it, but the one for donations and support is created by Radio Albion, and it is theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com, and there's no uppercase, there's no nothing, it's just the Orthodox Nationalist, you know. And anyway, I would appreciate any help in that regard. Last week, I just barely scratched the surface of Gambattista Vico's philosophy of history, or symbolism of history, as found in his New Science, and to a lesser extent, his autobiography. I got into Vico very intensely in my essay on the Enlightenment, because Vico was right dead center of the Enlightenment and fought it with every bone in his body. And he's not cited much, largely because, you know, conservatives aren't that bright. They couldn't read him. They're kicked out of academia, so they really don't have much of a chance. But and he's very difficult because, of course, the Enlightenment, the early Enlightenment theorists, I'm thinking Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and later on, Adam Smith, all had their own state of nature theories that were very simple. Which, of course, is their downfall. Nothing is simple. The social contract and the Leviathan, all this is really, it's simple and simplistic. Human beings have almost no qualities, and somehow, though, they get the, it's sort of like John Rawls' original position, which I've published on, too. You know, you want to posit man outside of law and language and religion and the state and including families, and yet somehow they know about contract law. They know how to cooperate. Somehow a language comes out of nowhere. And all these guys did was just import whatever it is that they wanted in their conclusions. They simply projected it onto their construction of man. This is there's never a time where man exists without a rudimentary civilization. There's never a time where man could exist without a rudimentary language. Man is extremely fragile. We're born completely helpless. We're not born free. And we are always fragile. We don't have fur. We don't have claws. And, you know, one little cut that can be infected, and that's the end of you. And yet, Rousseau and Hobbes, anyway, posit this wildly individualistic, non-existent world. It's simply a projection. And to this day, it's taken seriously. The basic model is that isolated, abstract humans somehow exist, somehow are capable of reason. There's no explanation of where that comes from. Capable of free choice, no understanding where that comes from. And something terrible happens, a natural disaster. They're sick of hurting each other. They're very insecure. They die young, whatever it is. And suddenly, at that moment, and this is not an exaggeration. This is not mockery here. This is what they say. At that moment, suddenly they develop this tremendous rational capacity that is able to weigh the pros and cons of giving up either some or all of their so-called natural liberty to an entity. Now, the entity, like the Leviathan state, it's not a monarchy by any sense. That's a very simple approach to it. But it is the all-powerful regime of one kind or another that exists exclusively to protect people from violent death, which, of course, means that it has no limitations. But to a great extent, it's so simplistically put out that it really doesn't have, like everything else, really doesn't have qualities. This is the core of something like reductionism. Reductionism is the very simplistic idea of reducing a complex phenomenon to one or two things. This has been an Enlightenment and a postmodern obsession for a long time. You know, class is what rules history. Passion is one thing, greed, whatever it is. Conformity, they have the very bad theory of evolutionary psychology, which really, you know, posits an existence of men prior to civilization. And it's only there where they develop their biases and instincts for self-preservation. Very convenient, since there are no records there. It is an assumption. So, for example, they'll say that envy, for example, I want to study envy, and they'll say envy developed prior to civilization because this is how men propelled themselves forward. They were envious of their neighbors, and so they worked hard to do better than their neighbors. And that's where envy comes from. They're upset, they're resentful at someone doing better than them, so that pushes them forward. And I've quoted, you know, important foundational documents of that very movement saying exactly that. And yet there's no explanation. You know, envy is based on private property. Envy is based on social comparison, which means there has to be a socially created yardstick. None of these have any explanation. There's no proof of it. It simply sounds good. So yes, that makes sense, and this is what we want to believe. It's no different. This ridiculous concept of man without civilization. Man can barely survive in civilization, let alone without it. Vico cut through a lot of this nonsense. And I'd forgotten last week, and I said a few things that may have been taken the wrong way, and in fact might have been misleading. I didn't mean to, of course, but this is a complex set of arguments. And the problem I have, and I just gave you the bare bones last week, I don't want, you know, there's this age of the gods. That shouldn't be equated with the Garden of Eden. In fact, the age of the gods is exactly what happens after the Garden of Eden. The point I was trying to get across is that human beings are more like children then. They could be violent children, but they're more like children and need that kind of repression. This is what happens. For Vico, history starts not with some abstract state of nature, but with what life was after the expulsion from the garden. Because the evil wanted to know about God, wanted power over one another. Cain built the first city, which is right in Genesis. there's a connection between the building of the first city and the rejection of God, and therefore Adam and Eve's removal from the garden. Now, I forgot this last week, and it's a bit embarrassing, but E. Michael Jones has an excellent piece on Vico. And I love his explanation. And I want to use him here to fill in a few gaps from last week. And I'm doing two parts of this because Vico is so damn important and relatively ignored. So many of the arguments that we make today, without us maybe being subjectively aware of it, derive from Vico right smack in the middle of the Enlightenment. And, you know, Jones was one of my first teachers. I've known him for many years, and he's a man intellectually I admire pretty much more than any other, I mean, living people today. He changed my thought process. He was one of the guys, along with Michael Hoffman, who snapped me out of modern categories. He put me on a completely different intellectual ground. The problem I had in grad school was that I was forced to face my opponents, either professorial or otherwise, on their own territory. I was using their language, I was using their assumptions, and I'm always a football team playing as a visiting team. They always had home field. They were defining the terms. Jones gave me the tools, and I'm looking right now at his Degenerate Moderns in particular, to understand the foundations of their worldview, of the regime's worldview, and the very foundations of it are weak. So rather than fighting it from their own foundations, which is almost impossible, I undercut those foundations. And that's what E. Michael Jones did for me, and that's what Vico did for Western civilization. So I didn't want to give the impression that somehow this initial age of the gods was one of perfection. It had a violent tendency. This is centuries after Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden. Already you have a certain rudimentary urbanization, as the book of Genesis says. You know, you have in every major civilization, Egyptian, etc., a story of a heroic being, I don't want to say divine, but a heroic being that somehow, in a sense, descended to these people and taught them the arts, geometry, all forms of mathematics, the sciences, navigation, star charts, and all the concomitant abilities you have, to make sense out of all of that. All kinds of architecture. None of them ever make the argument. None of the ancient texts ever say that, yes, we are people studied long and hard to get to this. They all, without exception, say that there was something or someone who appeared from out of nowhere and who taught them these arts. And this shift from Eden to civilization did happen very quickly. And because you wonder, where in heaven's name did Cain and his ilk get the wherewithal to build a city, quote unquote? There is a spiritual element to this. Now, when you read the Enlightenment theorist's conception of the state of nature, there was nothing. Suddenly, people got together and built a state or built a system of law like in John Locke. Somehow this ability just rushed to them. They don't give any explanation as to how this happened. And it's even hard to wonder, did these guys actually believe this? Or was this simply a way to communicate broader truths using images? It's hard to say. I think Rousseau did. You know, as I mentioned before, even in Hobbes's Leviathan and the De Civ, which in my opinion is the first political book of modernity, not so much Machiavelli, but Hobbes. I mean, they were from the same era, roughly, but mankind is matter in motion. Everything based on passions. Which passion is the strongest? That's what decision is. No free will. People following their own passion and self-interest against one another. The war of all against all that eventually has to be stopped from an exhausted population who all gets together in one place and suddenly has literacy. and puts together this all-powerful state, somehow has the an entity that can be all-powerful but no civilization. It's nonsensical at its root. And I can only say that as far as Hobbes is concerned, that this was simply an imaginary way to lay out his theory. It was a story. And Vico rejects that kind of silliness. Why wouldn't these guys, if you want to study what man really is prior to their era, why not go to the ancient myths? They had all of the, thank God for the monasteries that maintained all of these pre-Christian, very pre-Christian myths and stories. Myth meaning factual at root, but fanciful in detail, as Russell Kirk said. And see how, the early Gilgamesh, the earliest epics and stories, how man functioned. What kind of civilization are they talking about here? Clearly it was civilized because they were writing. And no one has given a satisfactory explanation in the secular world as to where language came from. Because the things that have to be present to have a language develop and spread, those things require language to exist. So it's this vicious cycle. And it's impressive that every civilization has this semi-divine, very Canaanite understanding of where this came from. Language is a very complex thing. Therefore, society had to be equally complex to create it. But you can't create a complex civilization without language. There was never a time, and in Vico's case here, never a time where mankind existed without principles of association. E. Michael Jones's, at least there's a few pages here in his book on Logos, which once you buy all of mine, please buy this. As always for him, it's 10,000 pages long. He published it himself on Fidelity Press, which has been his for a very long time. Everything he puts out is excellent. And he has a few pages in here on Vico. And I had to reread this. I can't believe, I forget about stuff all the time. I have so much going on. But I like, Michael Jones has this talent where, his PhD is in Temple and in American literature. And yet he can tackle, I've done the same thing, of course. He can tackle other fields with even more authority than specialists in that field. The only thing I disagree with him, probably the only thing I disagree with him is his analysis of Hegel. But of course I have a head start on him in that regard. His analysis of Vico is better than the academics. He is an academic like me, or we have very similar personal histories. Both were professors for a long time at a major Catholic university and got fired, were banned from campus for a while, I gave you the bare bones outline, and I understand how misinterpreting what I said is a possibility. I wrote, as I mentioned, this lengthy article on the Enlightenment, and of course I had no choice. I had to include Vico. It's difficult to talk about the Enlightenment without talking about the opposition that it created. History for Vico is not a set of abstractions. It's everything that occurred after the expulsion of Adam and Eve. And of course, the prodigy and the population growth and everything that occurred afterwards. And to some extent, he's not in full disagreement with Hobbes, just in terms of how this happens, that after a few centuries, mankind degenerated and degenerated into essentially bestialization. Rape was the normal order of things. Men simply were grabbing whoever they could, sacrifices to the frightening elements. Captured women, the crude weaponry, the very beginning of a settled life. Religion came from this fear. Now for Thomas Hobbes, this just exists from the rule of passion that comes from nothing. Here, he has a vague idea, Vico has a vague idea, of the same kind of brutish life which comes from the fall. That makes far more sense than the state of nature. And at this point, listen to what Vico says here. From what has been said up to this point, it is concluded that divine providence, apprehended by such human sense, it could have been possessed by rough, wild, and savage men, who in despair of nature's succours desired something superior to nature to save them, which is the first principle on which we have established the method of this science, permitted them to be deceived into fearing the false divinity of Jove, or Jehovah, or Jupiter, because he could strike them with lightning. Thus, through the thick clouds of those first tempests, intermittently lit by those flashes, they made out this great truth, that divine providence watches over the welfare of all mankind. God did not withdraw entirely. This was the great Protestant error of total depravity. Total depravity doesn't make a whole lot of sense. After centuries, after the fall, man got worse and worse. But settled habitation did develop, at least out of your initial war bands, and they began to till the soil, and private property in a very general sense developed. It rituals, the burial of the dead. This is what naturally going to develop in terms of increasing bestialization, while of course still having the rudiments from Cain of basic urbanization. There you have a simple, easily manipulated population. It's the thunderclap. Even Rousseau said this. It's the natural disasters, the fear that everything could be wiped away at any given moment, that created the most crude superstition. And yet, underneath all of that, is the idea of divine providence. Everything began to be associated with religious ceremonial. And it's the father of the great families. That was the king priest. And this is the origin of sacrificial ritual. Because these natural disasters seemed arbitrary. And this is the age of the gods. And what I meant last week was to say that they were in the same boat as Adam. They were very simple people, but unlike Adam, were driven by passion. That comes directly from the loss of the plenty of the garden. The great families, the earliest, and you do see this in the ancient myths, the great families, this very crude royalism that has, as he said, the bestial communism of women and the confusion of human needs as man slid further and further into mindlessness. And that is as close as Vico was willing to come to the state of nature. Unlike the great state of nature theorists that created the modern world, his comes directly from the records that exist, and not merely from Genesis. But many of the ancient texts, if anyone bothered to read them, are not too far away from Genesis, including civilizations that had zero contact with each other. We're talking about American Indians, we're talking about, you know, Central Americans, natives in even very small tribes in Africa and in parts of Asia, all very similar. Now, a lot of this, and I have a paper on this wandering around somewhere, the roving bands, these hunter-gatherers, they actually had, and the handful left, I don't know, you can really study the handful that's left, because I don't know if that's accurate, but you see a few in the Amazon and in Africa. They had a fairly complex social structure. They punished, they had marriage, they had burial of the dead, they had ritual, they had language, of course, and they usually killed adulterers, they killed thieves, you know, they had somewhat, I mean, given their status at the gerontocracy, they had a relatively complex, relative to them, social system. But where the heck did that come from? They don't have any technology. They are able to provide for themselves. I think they killed deformed babies. I mean, you know, most of those groups do. And again, it was E. Michael Jones who, in his analysis of Margaret Mead, the From Samoa book, which was a lie, she saw, first of all, she didn't know the language. She hardly even got off the boat. But she tried to make believe that these primitive Samoans had a full free love. There was no marriage. Everyone screwed anybody else. Homosexuality was tolerated. She invented it. And in the 20s, I think, she wrote her 30s. She went back to America, published her book on Samoa. and ushered in a very early sexual revolution. People said, oh, wait a minute, this is a state of nature. These people are the closest thing to a state of nature we can ever get, and that's how men really are. Therefore, all of our rules about sexuality and morality are based on convention. None of it was true. However, I'm guaranteeing you that they still promote Margaret Mead in sociology departments. That's the pathetic founder of that field. She made it all up. A guy named Friedman went over there not too long after that and studied the exact same phenomena and said, there's no way she could have gotten her conclusions from studying these people. Like all of these primitive tribes, they have a strict hierarchy, intensely powerful sexual mores. Again, the killing of adulterers is pretty much universal. Homosexuality is considered, as all civilizations, a freakish delusion. Nothing that, of course, Margaret Mead herself was very sexually liberated. She had a lesbian lover way back then. She had at least two, had a husband and boyfriend and everything else. And she had that long before she went over to Samoa. In other words, she went over to Samoa to project her own depravity onto them and therefore console herself that, yeah, that this is what men did in the beginning and that's what man really is. Therefore, I'm doing the natural thing. That's actually the thesis of E. Michael Jones's Degenerate Moderns. If you haven't read this, you know, you aren't going to be educated in this field unless you've read that book, because it will blow all of your assumptions about the world away. The rotted foundations on sand of the modern world just collapse. All of these moderns had severe degeneracy, and rather than fix the degeneracy, they tried to rewrite nature and history to justify it. And of course, he deals with Freud, even deals with Luther. And it changed my life forever. I quote from that book almost every day of my life. So just like Hobbes and Locke to a great extent, Margaret Mead and this whole tradition invented the hunter-gatherer idea, saying that they were lived free and happy. Yeah, in many ways, they are happier than we are. But to think that they had no law, they were strictly hierarchical, the strongest male eats first, etc., etc. And of course, when it came to family and marriage, they were extremely strict, as all civilizations were until this one. The argument, of course, that I've come to accept is that these tribes haven't been in static for millennia. They actually are the derivative of older civilizations. Because again, where does this hierarchy come from? They have ideas and artwork that could not have come from their little world. This is what's left of a broken civilization rather than the antecedent to civilization. Because again, they've never been able, this psychological evolutionary scheme, to figure out where the surplus would come from to create the massive edifices of ancient civilization. The documentary record is that there seems to be nothing, and boom, pyramids. And they won't take seriously the very Egyptian I spent a lot of time studying, the worship of Set in Egypt, because it's our origin of Satan. Actually, it's the first syllable. Set being the inversion of everything, including technology. They did have extraordinary technology in Egypt. Where did it come from, and why so suddenly? Document, and this goes from all over the world in Mesopotamia. So, the fall from grace occurs, mankind degenerates, but like these tribes, the memories of civilization remain. The mentality of the garden, the Canaanite civilization, which occurred in Babylon, which occurred almost immediately after the fall. And it makes sense, of course. This was the attempt to reach God. This was the attempt, and, God becomes generally forgotten over time. Now, this is what we would call the primitive stage of social organization. This is the age of the gods. I did not, under any circumstances, want last week for anyone to think that this was a golden age in the sense that the Romans used the term. No, it was a golden age in the sense that you did not have reflection. You had a childlike fear and worship of power. It comes from bestialization. which comes from the fall. But you did not have reflective thought. You had only the very beginnings of poetry. But you see this in, you know, even people like Hesiod. There was this fear of the gods. And it was not fear in the sense of respect. It was the most primitive thing, but it was intuition. You didn't have, even necessarily until a little bit later, written law codes. This was simply custom. This was the center of the father in direct communication with the gods that derive from their very own fear. This is what happened. I mean, there's not, you know, the New Testament really kind of glosses over this period of time between the fall and the beginning of civilization. But what the outline that it does offer is very telling, because it is perfectly in line with the ancient stories of Egypt and Mesopotamia and to a lesser extent even China. Now, I also mentioned that this gives way to something. It gives way to the age of the heroes. This powerful warrior aristocracy. And E. Michael Jones says, the age of the heroes is characterized by men's flight. Now, he's quoting Vico here, from the infamous and bestial promiscuity, in order to save themselves from the strife it entailed, and had taken refuge in the asylums of the heroes. And, of course, we know that even to this day, taking refuge in a temple is supposed to be safe. And this is the origin of that. So you had isolated individuals, post-flood, Noahide population growth. That gives way, of course, to the age of the great families, organizing for protection and basic law without any morality whatsoever. It was based on fear and really came from shame, as you see the very fall came from shame, and created the most rudimentary concepts of religion and ritual. It also created the very first conceptions of settled agriculture and, therefore, private property. But even there, this is a dynamic movement. Basic morality is being laid down as this develops. And as these families grow, and we talked about the killing of the king ritual, this is similar but not identical. Those who were young and strong remove themselves from the rule of these patriarchs and create their own systems. Vico says, since they were settled on the lands and could no longer escape by flight, as they had previously done in their bestial wanderings, in order to defend themselves and their families, they had to kill the wild beasts that attacked them. And in order to provide sustenance for themselves and their families, as they had ceased foraging, they had to tame the earth and sow grain. All of this for the salvation of the nation, human race. As this is going on, of course, you have the foundations of morality. And one of the central outgrowths of this age of the heroes is marriage. What you had in the age of the patriarchs, without being questioned, was some variation of polygamy. The complete subjugation of weaker women, who, of course, is terrified of being violated as anyone else was, under the protection, so to speak, of the patriarchs. What develops out of this age of heroes is the one-woman, one-man marriage. It is a form of asceticism. Vico states, and he's quoting Tacitus on this one, that this is a lifelong union, and it was universal. It remained a custom of almost everyone, and, you know, you had other custom societies falling into polygamy or some version of that, but there's nothing more natural than the limitation of the passion, of the sexual passions that it solves by, at its best, marriage. It's an error. And there's some of the red pill guys who say this, and they're dead wrong, saying that the natural state of man is promiscuity. Well, that's true only in a sense. First of all, the harem was not a sex utopia. That comes from really 18th and 19th century British degenerates. The harem had nothing to do with sex. In fact, there was an Aryan king in Iran overthrown because he treated it that way. This was the whole civilization for women. Young women were protected, usually foreigners, protected for the sake of treaty enforcement. I can get into that some other time. Marriage was a way to control the male sex drive. Now, you didn't have a sexualized society. Only in the 20th century did you see the sexualization. Sex and looks and appearance and body parts and everything were not as mystified. They weren't mystified at all as they are now. And marriage had nothing to do with romantic love in the sense that we talk about it. Marriage and monogamy is one and the same thing. There was a, he cited J.D. Unwin's Sex and Culture. He studied 80 different nations and six great civilizations. And in all of these cases, the decline of these societies and civilizations was based on, quote, largely determined by the loosening of sexual conventions and lessening of monogamous relationships. That the sex drive had to be controlled and shifted to more productive work. And that would have far-reaching consequences for the development of civilization anywhere. So, Vico makes the claim at this point that the human mind can't understand itself subjectively as free unless it was able to turn itself on its own passions. Something that Plato talks about at great length, the entire Republic, 2,500 years ago. And he says, liberty was understood as holding in check the motions of lust and giving them another direction. This is what we call sublimation, what Jung would call sublimation. You can't have promiscuous intercourse in some random sense because that would dissipate energy. That has to be sublimated. Liberty, of course, doesn't come from the body. That wouldn't make any sense. Now, Thomas Hobbes' solution was to say, well, one passion is stronger than another. The passion for greed at some points in time is powerful than the passion for lust. But that doesn't make any sense because this has to be a sustained sublimation. You know, Freud's understanding was that civilization derives from the repression of the sex drive, and that energy gets placed elsewhere. Of course, Marcuse and the Frankfurt School, and Marcuse said in his own, you know, trying to join Freud and Marx, said, well, of course, we have civilization, so why is the sex drive still sublimated? We have the ability to produce whatever we need, and therefore we don't have to be repressing this anymore. And the sexual revolution in our era came largely from this myth. Every book Marcuse ever wrote has in the preface, or in the acknowledgments, I should say, thanks for the Rockefeller Foundation for financing this work. As, you know, as a Marxist, and you start realizing this stuff, you realize that the regime, of course, was very sympathetic to Marxism. It is an officially and overtly leftist phenomenon wherever it goes. Once men took to forcibly seizing women, as you see in the age of the patriarchs, in the so-called age of the gods, something else had to happen. Once it became clear that that would lead to social stagnation, mankind did develop the notion, and again, this is a providential idea too, that this passion has to be tightly controlled. What the hell did the moderns think was going to happen? When you take something as overwhelmingly powerful as a male sex drive and deliberately provoke it every day, every hour, what did they think was going to happen? And the addiction, the addictive nature of this, the dopamine, the chemicals that are produced at these times are highly addictive. What did they think was going to happen? Well, it's not that dissimilar here. The age of the heroes was typified by the fact that liberty became to be understood in the way that Plato put it. That and Plato had a relatively primitive concept of history too. But unless we start using the spiritual element of man to fight the physical element of man or the passionate element of man, freedom is impossible. And at least Thomas Hobbes was honest enough to say that no man is free. That man is driven by passion, and the control over it really only comes into existence when you fear for your very life. That could override anything. Beyond that, of course, he had very little to say. Natrimony was developed similar to that of any kind of proprietarian relation. And man began to be worried, because you have private property now. I want to make sure that my children are actually mine, because I'm going to give over my work to my own progeny, not some guy. And that women had their status go up from the age of the gods, or the intuitive worship and fear of the gods and the patriarchs, to now a trustworthy companion. Because to a certain extent, men, of course, died younger. The average age, you know, there was never a time where man lived, you know, I mean, hundreds of years in the ancient past, but 75 was normally the human lifespan, even back then. That not only was the woman a valued companion and mother, but also was someone you could leave your property to. Now, here's what Vico has to say, and he's talking about the transition from the age of the gods to the age of the heroes, and he says, the patriarchs founded the families and governed them with a cyclopean family sovereignty over their children and their wives, such as was proper to such proud and savage natures, so that later as cities arose, men might be found disposed to stand in awe of the civil sovereignty. Thus, Providence ordained certain household commonwealths of monarchic form under fathers, or in that state, princes, the best in age, sex, and virtue. So civilized behavior grew out of family life. The absurdity of polygamy leads to marriage, which certainly was the norm in the ancient world. So there's a connection between civilization and family life, because, and this is how he describes men in these kind of legitimate monogamous relationships. These men were also endowed with prudence, taking counsel from the auspices of the gods, with temperance, each coupling chastely with the one woman whom he had taken under the divine auspices as perpetual companion for life, with strength for slaying beasts and taming the earth, and with magnanimity in giving succor to the weak and aid to those in danger. Such was the nature of the Herclugian commonwealth, in which the pious, wise, chaste, strong, and magnanimous cast down the proud and defended the weak, which is a mark of excellence in civil government. Notice he is deliberately using the language of the ancient world. I said last week that there is definitely, you know, the history of mankind has to be, at least initially, found in the myths. These are some of the earliest documents that we have. The Enlightenment mentality, though, no one bothered with this stuff. It was seen to be just mindless superstition. We can learn nothing from it. And so you have stupid things like the state of nature. You have stupid things like the Adam Smith's 1776 invisible hand. Once you had now this growth of a warrior aristocracy, escaping the age of the gods, escaping that kind of tyranny, and becoming something other than simple people, are starting to question things, especially themselves. Those who were incapable of making that jump, and this is very important, simply couldn't function. Now, I'm not necessarily going so far as interpreting Vico as to say that there's a difference between the development of civilization on the one hand and the roving nomads on the other, the nomads being those who couldn't make the cut. I am not saying that, and I don't think that Vico is saying that, but you can actually make some kind of a connection here. The age of the heroes. And let me, again, quote Vico as to what he has to say in this. And I'm taking this from the new style, also E. Michael Jones's study, which is absolutely perfect here. It says, meanwhile, scattered through the plains and valleys and preserving the infamous promiscuity of things and of women, there remained a great number of the impious, unchaste, and nefarious, impious in having no fear of gods, unchaste in their use of shameless bestial venery, and nefarious in their frequent intercourse with their own mothers and daughters. After a long time, driven by the ills occasioned by their bestial society, weak, astray, solitary, relentlessly pursued by the robust and violent, because of quarrels engendered by their infamous promiscuity, they came at last to seek refuge in the asylums of the fathers. Now, it's a very common question. You know, we talk about the Old Testament, we talk about the wiping out of whole civilization. This was commanded by God, and you were punished, as Moses was, if you didn't slaughter everything from the leaders to the bugs. It's because of exactly what Vico was talking about here. The bestiality, and I mean that in all senses of the word, was so out of control that the entire society was infected by it. There was no redeeming them because the very language and lifestyle of these people, they couldn't think in any other way. And they simply had to go. God doesn't love everyone. Obviously not. It's one of those stupid things that, or at least in our sense of the word love, they have a role to play. But the fact that they were wiped out in massive numbers relative to them by Moses himself suggested that, of course, you know, the world that God created is a two-tiered system. Now there's another transition. The age of the heroes might be said to be the age of the warrior aristocracy and the beginnings of questioning not only their own passions, but the world around them. These warrior aristocrats ruled over serfs in the same sense that the Spartans ruled over their peasants. They sought asylum. I mean, these were wandering people who couldn't function anymore in wandering. It was too difficult. And they came to the growing civilizations of the strong. These civilizations always founded by a single person or a family. Instead of defending the weak, which is the mark of excellence, as Vico says, several places, they were then exploited. And they were seen as a lower order of human being because they weren't able to make that jump with them. They had to make that jump by force. And even their own right to marry was interfered with by the still more or less bestial aristocracy. Now we have a class distinction that enters history for the very first time. And these plebeians, or you know, some vague sense of a proletariat, they didn't have the rights of their social betters. They weren't permitted direct heirs, rights of succession, and ultimately the disposal of their own fields and labor were taken in greater and greater percentages by their social betters. They did not have equal standing before God in this very primitive state. But the family fathers, as Vico would put it, they have become great through the institutions of religion and the beginnings of civil society. They did begin to abuse those under them. They got a taste of what labor exploitation is, and that is greater wealth for themselves. You see for the first time the institution of slavery, and at the same time, the institution of the slave rebellion. We mentioned this indirectly in Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. Now, what happens when these owners, so to speak, are faced with slave rebellion? Their only option, again, this is also the beginning, you're talking about basic cognition here. They had to band together. And let me quote directly from Vico. To pacify these plebeians, they conceded to them, in the world's first agrarian law, monetary ownership of the fields, retaining for themselves the optimal or sovereign family ownership. Thus, the first cities arose upon reigning orders of nobles, as a natural order declined, which had been based in accordance with then the state of nature, on the superiority of kind, sex, age, virtue. Providence called the civil order into being along with the cities. Civil order in terms of a basic reflective conception of human nature and what law should be. The very first sense of hierarchy, but equality in terms of being necessary for the social system to function at all. The heroic state the beginning of a more or less complex civilization, ultimately was typified by class conflict of really only two classes. More classes came a bit later. And law grew directly out of this. Again, I talked about the age of the gods, early age of the heroes, as a golden age, only in the sense that language didn't cover this stuff. It still was rudimentary, at least as far as civil society was concerned. Law was not written down. It was basic custom that could be altered as circumstances changed. Only as the age of the heroes began to break down in the abuse of the aristocracy. Again, this is all post-lapsarian. This is what happens when man has forgotten God. God has not forgotten man. This ushers in what we then call the modern age. The modern age, I guess, at Vico's time. This is the human age, the age of men, the Iron Age. And this is not necessarily a good thing. It's providential. God's idea is being slowly built up in this history, which derives from the decay of what human passions are able to create. Reason was not able to control the passions of this aristocratic class. This is the development of rationality, especially when it comes to politics, actually the very origin of what politics are. Rational human beings are intelligent and hence modest, benign, and reasonable, recognizing laws of conscience, reason, and duty. Now, you had the rise of general literacy, but you did have the collapse of imagination. And this is where, as I said last week, René Descartes becomes the central figure. That I also want to say Hobbes is a central figure, although Vico did mention him. This is the age of man's law. This is the development of human reason, the ability to question everything and demand answers for the basic elements of society and even material life. Contract theory is not to be found in the state of nature, in a world beyond records and beyond civilization and beyond anything else. It comes from the decay of the age of the aristocracy, or the age of the heroes. It derives from slave rebellion, and it derives from the fact that those under the heroic rule, the rule of this warrior aristocracy, began to realize that together they have power. They have numbers and they have the desire to rectify. There's no right or wrong here. Vico is not, his book is called The New Science. He's not making judgment. This is simply how it happened, literally and philosophically speaking. And again, Hegel takes directly from this. Contract law derives from this very phenomenon. When those who are being treated harshly because of their low station start to question this. See, the age of the gods, there was no such thing as questioning anything. The age of the heroes is questioning your own passion. You know, the concept of self-interest develops. And only in this age, generally speaking, vaguely speaking, the modern age, and I think it means that very broadly, because not a lot of this is actually literal, but it is found in the ancient documents. You know, that's the problem with all of these kinds of very general philosophies of history, whether it be Hegelian or even Eric Voegelin. They highly simplify the society. People like Leontief, all the great philosophies of history, even Pufendorf. This all derives from a simplification. You can't summarize Israelite civilization in two or three paragraphs. Now, Eric Voegelin does have multiple volumes on this, and it's very important. But you can understand the sweep of history without it in this mentality. And Karl Marx, having one of the worst, most simplified philosophies of history, where everything is driven by class interests at all times. From the very dawn of civilization to today, class interest is the only thing that really, really matters. Law and contract and concepts of justice and right derive from slave rebellion. And it derives from two sides. A, the fact that the rulers have to band together and create what we call the modern state to fight this, to make sure that this doesn't happen. And B, the collective efforts of the lower orders. The fruit of that collaboration is called government, or the fatherland. The rule of law, in our sense of the term, they united, and again this is a quote, united their private interests in a common interest called patria, or the fatherland. Patria in res is the interests of the fathers. Again, that's Jones's analysis of the whole thing. This is where the words like patricians come into existence, because the patricians were the only citizens of the first patriae. That was changing slowly. And so the order here, you know, the forests, the huts, the villages, cities, and the academies. Now, that brings us to the modern age. The way to understand it is that, at least in European life, Catholicism and Orthodoxy, the sacramental religion, took the place of that, I don't even want to call them religions, the frightful religions of the thunderclaps and the fear, the age of the gods. The Middle Ages developed, and the Age of the Heroes was recapitulated. And then, of course, 17th century, the product of the decay of that era, the rule of law. Now, even that stage is going to decline. That's where we are. I'm not even sure Vigo could fully understand this. The decline of the third stage is the recursion. It begins with skepticism. Now people are questioning to such an extent that there is no stability. There is no stability in any relationship. What's happening now is that even reason itself, law itself, orders, hierarchy, even that is all coming into question. It eventually will rot even the foundation that it created. Because these movements of history were parasitic on the basic faith and devotion of the first age. Once the concept of questioning and human reason began to be used against anything and everything, even the most basic foundations have fallen to pieces. The basic principles from even these earlier eras will collapse. And it then collapses in what I guess is, you can't really even call it an age, but this will create what we live in now, an age of wild beasts far worse than the initial state of primitivism. He calls it the barbarism of reflection. That reason begins to even question itself, destroying even that as a foundation for human interaction. It destroys all sense of common ties, including nation and ethnicity and religion. Everything is brought into question. All you have left, back again, are these isolated, angry, alienated people who have nothing holding them together. It's not, you know, the initial age of barbarism, the age of the gods, and even prior to that, was based on ignorance and simplicity, the same kind of simplicity and innocence that they had in a garden. And yes, it could be very bestial, but they simply didn't know any better. Again, this is not a moral matter. It becomes a moral matter in our era. It becomes a moral matter in the recurso. A level of decadence where the idea of questioning itself becomes questioned. The idea of right and order itself becomes questioned, and then that set of questioning becomes questioned. No foundations remain, which is the very nature of postmodernism. Vico even went so far as to say Machiavelli started this. This long drawn out destruction that that began, you know, in his own era. He didn't necessarily have the vocabulary to describe it. But as E. Michael Jones was saying, as the thesis of his whole book, hatred of logos leads to the barbarism of reflection. And that is where Vico's history ends. Once these new states, based on the rule of law, become corrupt, and reason itself is questioned, families are questioned, all of these ties are questioned, even the very relation between mind and body are created and questioned, and the nonsensical era we live in, which is no longer even human. Only the regime has reality today. What it comes down to is a level of skepticism in pure decadence. I'm going to end here. I want to quote from Vico. And it's one of the great quotes, because he's describing the mentality of this age in a way that was purely prophetic. He's talking about the mentality of people, especially intellectuals, in the age prior to the total destruction of society. Reason is characterized by a formal use of the intellect, whose substantial foundation has been lost by a decline of the emotional ties that keep cultures and civilizations together, by a rationally calculating attitude towards one's own fellow human beings, which is concealed by empty forms, by the lack of any faith in work that concerns the community and transcends the individual's particular interests, by the annihilation of an authentically lived intersubjectivity, and by general socio-psychological irritability. Now remember, I'm talking, this is a secondary source here. This is from Jones's book directly. I'm not quoting Vico directly. Sorry about that. They no longer believe in any truth, but they cultivate a level of erudition to show off they despise one another, but are pathologically dependent on mutual recognition, since the feeling that these heteronomous beings have of their own value is not maintained by any direct relationship with things. The basic principles of humanity, religion, marriage, funerals, waste away. And even if Vico explains this process only in reference to religion, it undoubtedly follows from his theory that the dissolution of marriage and the sexualization of every field of life are phenomenon of decadence, like the denial of death, the destruction of the feeling of piety, and with that, the whirling dismantling of traditions which must deepen the identity crisis of a culture. Now, I'm sorry about that. That was not directly from Vico, of course. That's a secondary source. That's Hostler's book. Also found to be found in Jones's. But it doesn't matter, because that's precisely what Vico had predicted. He was only talking about it, as we say, in religion, but he laid out what ultimately comes down to the destruction of all society and humanity. This is a level of decadence that doesn't really have a term. Even we haven't fully grasped it, because there's nothing to grasp. This quote explains postmodern societies. There's nothing to philosophize about, because reason itself is mocked as a masculine construct or something stupid, deriving from the over-emotional feminization of academia. And yet, it still is providential. Because just like in the ancient world, this creates its own reaction. I hope that some of us are in the forefront of this reaction. The only thing that's left is self-interest and arrogance and money. But money is just an abstraction from things in labor. Money only takes value because people make things. So I hope this clarifies. Last week's talk on Giambattista Vico and how important this man is in understanding our era. It's also true that there's several ways to understand this schema. I first presented it as something starting from the end of the garden to today. Yeah, maybe. But this is cyclic. Every era has this same cycle. What do you do? How do you get people out of savagery, if not the mentality of the Age of the Gods? That can't last, so it creates the Age of the Aristocrats, and then the rule of law. This has recurred and recurred and recurred since the garden. So this is both a macro and a micro understanding of the historical process. I hope I clarified everything. Ego is not easy, and yet he allows us to understand at both micro and macro levels what this cycle is and where it comes from. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.